Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. Remember to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. Now, here's our pastor and teacher, Jim McLarty.
Turn to 2 Kings chapter 6. That's where we're picking up tonight. Chapter 6 of 2 Kings, the first 7 verses are about yet another miracle that Elisha does. And I have looked in the last few days at several different commentaries just to see if anybody saw anything in here that was significant theologically. And usually what I found was people just kind of stretching it to try to find something to comment on. The truth of the matter is, these 7 verses exist because they exist. The author found it important to cite it. It's a significant miracle on the part of Elisha, but there's no real significant theological background underpinning or teaching to it that I could find anywhere. I think it's included as yet another demonstration of the fact that Elijah had twice the spirit that was on Elijah. And he did miracles unlike anything that folks had seen. In this case, he's going to make an iron axe head float because one of his students had borrowed the axe. And that's kind of the whole story. But then the chapter really opens up. And you get an insight into the depth of Elisha's knowledge, the kind of things that God was telling Elisha, the kinds of things that Elisha was aware of, that he was able to go to the king of Israel and tell him what the king of the Arameans was doing. Where was he traveling to? What was his plan? And so here again, a demonstration of God taking care of his own people and protecting his own people. And yet these are the same Israelites who once in a while God would allow the foreigners, the Arameans, to conquer them. Sometimes God would allow them to lose wars because they didn't consult with him first or give him the glory in it. And yet in this moment in time, God purposefully is allowing Elisha to know everything the king of the Arameans is doing and thinking, so that he can tell the king of Israel, so that the king of Israel stays a step ahead of him. But then, to these very same people, through the area of Samaria, there is a drought that comes, and the drought is so bad, the famine is so bad in the land, that we're even going to read a story of women eating their children. That's how bad it gets for them. So here the same God protects Israel, but then the same God punishes Israel, and then the same God miraculously delivers them food. And so all of that is chapter 6 and chapter 7 of 2 Kings. And in the middle of all that, we get a vision of angels. In the middle of all that, we get some of the basis for some New Testament thinking about guardian angels or the fact that we are protected from on high. All of that is in this chapter. It's really jam-packed with interesting stuff, interesting revelations of the way that God works. Now, we'll talk about this more as we work through it, but I'm trying to show you the contrast that you're about to see. Because the same God who delivers the king of Israel by allowing Elisha to know everything that the king of the Arameans is thinking and doing, when Elisha and his servant are surrounded by the armies of their enemies, the famous quote that I'm sure you've heard, Elisha says, "They that are with us are more than they that are with them." Elisha was conscious of the heavenly realm, the angelic realm, that were there protecting them. And yet, despite angelic protection and being the people that were chosen by God, they still had to go through the famine. Mm-hmm. But God hadn't abandoned them through the famine. A famine so bad that, as I said, cannibalism erupted in Samaria. And yet God was still there and still turned the tide for them and still provided them food. And so I think we can extrapolate from that. God is in all of this. And it is so easy for us to think God's in the good stuff. God's in the protecting us stuff. God, send me angels to fight my battles for me. That's the stuff God does. But when it goes bad, famine, cannibalism, terrible bad, it's the same God. And that theme runs all the way through the Bible, whether it's Job saying to his wife, we've received good things, blessings from the hand of God. Shouldn't we also receive the hardships that come from him? That they all have purpose. Everything that happens in your lifetime, I have said over and over again, everything that happens in your lifetime is a result of the fact that this is what God has intended for you at this very moment. And he hasn't forgotten about you. He hasn't reneged on his choice of you. He hasn't turned away from his election. He hasn't fallen off his throne. He hasn't forgotten. He's doing what is necessary to bring you to the ultimate glory that he has designed for you since before the foundation of the world. We like it when it all's going good and it's all going easy and it's all going well, and it's real easy to praise and worship God during those times. It's harder to worship him when it's going tough, but it's more important to worship him when it's going tough. To always focus on the fact that God is in it, in the midst of it, and knows what he's doing. And if he takes the blinders off your eyes, you'll look around and realize that there are angels on the hills all around you. And you have to remember that. So there, that's the synopsis of what we're going to read tonight. Starting in chapter 6, verse 1. These first seven verses, like I said, are about recovering an iron axe head out of the water. And I have no application for it at all. I could extrapolate wildly if you'd like. If you have nowhere to be and nothing to do, I could make up some stuff. But here's the story. Chapter 6, verse 1. Now the sons of the prophets said to Elijah, behold now, the place before you where we are living is too limited for us. Apparently they were all living together, had some kind of a house that they were living in. And notice that they're right there near Elisha. I think that's significant. Wherever Elisha would go, of course, the sons of the prophets would go with him, especially considering that he's the one who has the double portion of the spirit that was on Elijah. And so, of course, if there's somebody like that in your midst, you go wherever he is. So they say, please let us go to the Jordan, and each of us will take from there a beam, a piece of wood, and let us make a place there for ourselves where we may live. And he said, okay, go. Then one of them said, please be willing to go with your servants. And he answered, I shall go. Now, one commentator did make a point here that I thought was an interesting point. He said, notice that Elisha, despite the fact that he is the prophet to Israel, despite the fact that he does have counsel with the king, despite the fact that he hears directly from God, still hung out with his students. When they said, let's go chop wood, he went with them to go cut wood, to go make a house for them. That he didn't consider himself to be above them. That he was humble in his demeanor and that he interacted with his students and his disciples. And of course, the particular commentator I was reading then applied that and said that church leaders need to follow that example of humility. So a little extra application there. But it is interesting that Elisha, this same Elisha, who when kings and leaders of kings would come to him, he wouldn't even go out to see them. We saw it last week. We saw it 2-3 weeks ago. Wouldn't go out to see them, didn't care who anybody was, wasn't impressed by the high and mighty. But in this instance, they asked him, come with us. Come with us to the Jordan. Let's go build a house. And he said, okay, I'll go with you. Well, I like that attitude. Verse 4 says, so he went with them, And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was felling a beam, the axe head fell into the water. Now, of course, the trees, of course, the best trees are going to be right along the shoreline because they're getting the most water. And so they're right along the shoreline, and he obviously swung back with the intention of swinging forward into the tree. And when he swung back, the axe head flew off the handle, plunk, into the water. If you don't like the sound effect plunk, you can make up your own sound effect for axe head falling into water. Go ahead, Marilyn. No. Okay, just checking. So he said, verse 5, but as one of them was felling a beam, an axe head fell into the water, and he cried out, and he said, alas, my master, which means, oh no, bad news, my master, for it was borrowed. I borrowed that from somebody. Now, again, one of these commentators I read said, it's interesting, this tells you a little bit about the financial well-being of these students of Elisha's, that they didn't even own their own tools. When they went to do some work, they would have to borrow some. So that shows you a little bit about their financial state. So the man of God said, where did it fall? And when he showed him the place, he cut off a stick and he threw it in there and he made the iron float. Now you may well ask, what's the significance of the stick that he threw into the water? There are sermons you can find right now on this passage, go on the internet and find them, where people will say that the axe head came up out of the water and then attached itself to the stick so that it became a new whole axe. The text doesn't say that, and there's no significance to imposing that on the story. It's enough that an iron axe head is floating. That's pretty good on its own. You don't have to make the stick and the axe connect. The significance of the stick, we simply don't know. Outside of he threw it out to the place, the stick would have floated, like wood, it would have floated. The axe head floated, apparently in the area that the stick floated. But he turned and said, take it up for yourself. So he put out his hand and he took it up. Now that is marvelous. I've never seen anything like it. I'm not likely to see anything like it, but it demonstrates yet again that Elisha had this kind of miraculous power. And then, with no explanation, the author leaps right to verse 8. Now the king of Aram was warring against Israel. I want more information. I want to know more about this. He didn't feel it was necessary to tell us. So we'll go on into the narrative, starting in verse 8. Now the king of Aram was warring against Israel, and he counseled with his servants, saying, in such and such a place shall be my camp. In other words, he's planning to go to war against Israel, and he's going to set up camp in a convenient place, probably in a valley where they would be able to surge from into Israel. But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, saying, beware that you don't pass through this place, for the Arameans are coming down there. So he knows exactly what the king is planning in private. And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God had told him, and thus he warned him, so that he guarded himself there more than once or twice. So this happened several times. When the Aramean army and the king of the Arameans would move, Elisha would tell the king of Israel where they were. And the king of Israel managed to keep avoiding them. Had he been in the same area they were in, that would have brought about the war that the Arameans wanted. And so they kept avoiding him and kept avoiding the war, because Elisha kept telling them where the king was. So now verse 11, now the heart of the king of Aram was enraged over this thing. Because every time he'd go and move and set up camp, and go, okay, now we're going to get him. He wouldn't be there. He'd go somewhere else. He kept changing his location ahead of the king of Aram. And he called his servants and he said to them, will you tell me which of us is for the king of Israel? He assumed that the only way this could be taking place is if he had a spy in his camp, and that the spy in the camp was telling the king of Israel what was happening. And they respond in verse 12. One of the servants said, "No, my king. No, my lord, O king. But Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." Yeah, that's why this is happening. Because God is actually for Israel. And he's not for you. And you want to attack his people. And God's not going to let you. And he's using Elisha the prophet to tell the king of Israel what you're doing. You don't have a spy in your camp. There are no turncoats. There's nobody in here listening and going and telling the king. In fact, you, even if you went into your closet, if you went into your bedroom and you spoke to one other person, the God of Israel would carry that to Elisha and tell him, you don't need spies in your camp. You've already got the God of Israel fighting for Israel. So he said, verse 13, "Go and see where he is, where Elisha is, that I may send and take him." And it was told him, saying, "Behold, he is in Dothan." Now, the king naturally, this is a good strategic move from a military standpoint, seems like a good strategic move. Well, if he's the cause, if he's the problem, if Elisha is telling the king of Israel what I'm doing all the time, well, then I just need to eliminate him. If I can eliminate Elisha, then I can go ahead and attack Israel. This just makes sense. The only thing he didn't seem to think through was, God talks to this guy. The God of Israel tells this guy stuff. You may not want to go after him. But natural human thinking, we'll just go after the people of God. This should be a bit of a lesson to our leaders at this very moment. Because God has a long, rich history of defending his people, as we're going to see again in a moment. And when you go after and when you attack the people that God is for, well, then you're against God. And God is against you. That's a warning. So, verse 14. "So he sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and they surrounded the city." For one guy. They sent a big army and they send chariots. They send this whole group in. Verse 15. "Now when the attendant of the man of God," this is the servant of Elisha, "rose early and had gone out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was circling the city. And his servant said to him, 'Alas,'" there's that word again. That's, oh no, that's what are we going to do? "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" Verse 16, "And he answered, 'Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them.'" Now, in terms of actual numbers of human beings, the army that was outside the walls of Dothan were more than the people that were inside Dothan, especially the number of people within Dothan that could go out and fight. Archers, people with swords. You had a lot of women, you had a lot of children, you just have people in the city. And so his servant would naturally look around and go, no, just raw numbers, just head count. It's just obvious that, no, they have more than we have. But what Elisha had that his servant didn't have was the heavenly perspective. And that's the perspective that we have to hang on to all the time. I've talked many times about God consciousness, the awareness that God is here. God is here right now. God is not only here, but he's aware. God is here right now. He's involved. God is here right now, and he has not left us to ourselves. God is here right now, and he has intimate knowledge of what we're going through. God is here right now. He hasn't abandoned you, and whatever you're going through is what he has intended for you to go through. But he's here, and he knows, and he cares, and he's involved. Theologically, we use terminology in describing God like we say that he's omniscient, that he knows everything. But we also say that he's omnipresent. Always present at all places in all times. Very hard for us to wrap our brains around, but it's certainly the way God is described. You never see a description of God where he is limited to one area. Oh, good, God's over there, so he's not here now. I can do whatever I want. Instead, you see this universality to the presence of God. And so we need to remember that God is here. He's here now. He's here now and he cares. He's here now and he's aware. He's here now and he knows what his people are going through. And that is the realization that Elisha had after all of his interaction with God. And he also has the angelic perspective and realizes that God has armies that can fight for him. And that language exists, like in the book of Daniel. That's what Nebuchadnezzar said, that God was in charge of the inhabitants of the earth and the armies of heaven. God has angelic armies that can fight for him. Lord of hosts, Lord Sabaoth. I grew up as a Lutheran singing that. It means Lord of hosts. It means he's the Lord of all the inhabitants and the armies and the angelic creatures. Remember that when Gabriel came to speak to Daniel, that he told Daniel, you know, I heard your prayer 21 days ago, and I have been warring with, and he refers to him as the king of Persia. But he wasn't really warring with the king of Persia. He was warring with the demonic force that was behind, the demonic entity that drove the king of Persia. And he says, Michael is right now dealing with him so that I could come talk to you. And then when I leave, we're going to go whip up on the king of Persia. And then he says, but behold, the prince of Grecia comes. So that once that vacuum exists, once the demonic force that is leading the king of Persia, who is attacking and holding Israel in subjection, once he's gone, that vacuum is going to be filled by the king of Grecia, who is Alexander the Great. And so when we see these armies, when we see these leaders, when we see these kings, these forces on earth that are attacking Israel, that is always driven by a genuine evil in the heavenly realm. And that evil isn't attacking us all the time and hurting us and harming us all the time, because the angelic realm exists and protects God's people. And that's good to know. Somebody turn to Matthew 18:10 for a moment, because Jesus makes this really interesting comment in Matthew, talking about children, talking about younger folk, less educated folk. Somebody got Matthew 18:10?
Yes.
You got it?
Yes.
Read it for us nice and loud.
See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven, their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven.
Okay, now what does that mean? This is Jesus. He would know. He's the authority. He's the one who speaks of heaven with intimate knowledge. And he says, don't despise one of these little ones. One of these younger, less educated ones coming to him, belong to him. And he says, don't look down on them. Don't despise them, because, here's his rationale and reason, because their angels always see the face of my Father. So angels that stand before God watch over and take care of these little ones. So this concept of angelic protection runs all the way through Scripture. And that, again, we have to recognize. God understands the heavenly and the demonic realm in ways that we simply don't. And he has power that we simply don't have. And he has authority that we don't have. And if he did not exercise that power and authority and knowledge on our behalf, then we're a goner. But he protects us, and he has armies, legions of angels that protect us. And that's good to know. It's good to know that God has sent angels to care for his people. So here's what happens. Verse 17, then Elisha prayed and said, O Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So that's why Elisha wasn't worried. Like, oh, there's some man-made army out there? Wants to come get me? I'm really not worried. Have you noticed there are chariots of fire out there? Notice, by the way, this is the same description of the type of chariot that came down and scooped Elijah up off the planet, that Elisha himself called the chariots of Israel. So these angelic hosts with horses and chariots of fire also belong to Israel, according to Elisha. They're there to protect Israel. They're there to protect God's people. So Elisha is completely confident. Notice, however, another really significant thing. Even though Elisha could see that, his servant couldn't. And that is the state of human beings. All that exists, we just can't see it. God had to remove whatever natural blindness we have, those scales, that veil, whatever it is that keeps us from seeing the heavenly things that are going on all around us. And I think God does that on purpose to protect us, because if we ever saw what was really going on around us, we'd probably never sleep. It would just be either too frightening or too entertaining all at the same time. We are surrounded by both demonic and angelic activity, but we don't know about it. When Paul writes, "We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and the rulers of the darkness of this world and spiritual wickedness in high places." Well, he described heavenly battles, but he used that word kosmokratos, the rulers of the darkness of this world. That combination is cosmos and kratos, rulers. So the rulers of this world, dark rulers here on the planet. And so that is going on. That exists. That's on around us. The angelic beings are around us. The activity between heaven and earth that is actively bringing about the will and the purpose of God is happening all around us. And it takes God to open our eyes to give us the ability to be able to see any of it. Yes?
We also know that of the vast portion of wavelength of light, only a very small portion of that is actually available to our eyes to see.
Right.
And we can't see X-rays or cosmic rays or
right.
Just about all of it we can't see.
Exactly. The vast majority of the spectrum of light is outside of our ability to look at. Yeah. We know it exists. My dad, as he was dying in the last few months of his time here on earth, I shouldn't say months, last few weeks of his time here on earth, began having visitations from angels. My mom was with him once when he suddenly just, his gaze, he just locked his gaze and was just staring at the end of the bed. And mom said, "What, Ed?" And he said, "They're here." He was very weak. This is within a day, I think, of actually dying. He could barely speak anymore. And she said, "What do they look like?" Which is such a natural question. What do they look like? And the only word he spoke was tall. And I told Mom later, I said, "Well, yeah, you don't want God to send the wimpy angels. You know, this is important. Send the tall guys." Yeah. But those angelic visitations was the beginning of my mom's conversion. Even though she had been in church most of her life, she really didn't care about the things of God until it became real for her. And so I am convinced of the existence of angels, but the reason I am convinced of them is because, again, as I said last week, I start with Christ. What does Christ think? If he has proven himself to be who he says he is, what does he think on the topic? And he spoke of angels. Angels came and ministered to him, fed him after his 40 days and 40 nights. So I'm convinced of the existence of angels because Jesus is convinced of the existence of angels. And when I read in the Bible the things that angels do, I find great comfort in the fact that angels exist. Because, as I've said before, I have encountered dark things. I'm glad to know that somebody has constantly got my back, because left to myself, can't do it. So Elijah prayed and said, O Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And when they came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, strike this people with blindness, I pray. So he struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. Now, don't miss the fact that when the attendant, the servant of the man of God, rose up early, that there was an entire army of horses and chariots that were circling the city. Horses, chariots, and a great army, according to verse 14. And God struck them all blind at Elisha's word. So now you have all these men and their horses, their chariots, all this splendor, all this army. They're ready to go. They think that they're powerful. They're ready to go. All of their confidence is in themselves. They're sure that they have the power within themselves to accomplish what their king has brought them there to do. And God smites them all blind. And nothing will stop progress faster than, oh, wait, I can't see anything. And they stop in their tracks. So Elisha then, and this is hysterical, Elisha goes out and does the Jedi mind trick to them. I've used examples before, but that was about as nerdy as my examples have ever gotten. I nerded right out there. At least it wasn't a Star Trek reference. But Elisha said to them, this is not the way, nor is this the city. This isn't where you're trying to go. The guy they came there to get, the whole army is there to get one guy. That guy, now that they can't see him, walks out and tells them, this isn't where you want to be. He's not in there. You're in the wrong place completely. Nor is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek. He is the man that they seek. Don't worry, I'll take you to him. And he brought them to Samaria, right into the heart of Israel. And it came about that when they had come into Samaria, that Elisha said, O Lord, open the eyes of these that they may see. So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the middle of Samaria. That's not where they intended to be. The city that they had come to originally was right along the shores of Jordan, easy to get back into your own territory. Now they're right in the middle of Samaria. They're surrounded by Israelites everywhere. Then the king of Israel, when he saw them, said to Elisha, my father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? And he said, you shall not kill them. Would you kill those that you have taken captive with your sword or with your bow? In other words, during a war, if you take people captive, you would keep captives, you wouldn't kill them. These are already your captives. There's no justifiable reason to kill them. They're not fighting against you, they're not at war, they're surrounded. Set bread and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master. In other words, Elisha was proving to them, I can whip up on you anytime I want. The God of Israel can confuse and confound you. You can surround the city where you think I am, and he'll put blindness on you, and I'll lead you right into the middle of the area where you're surrounded by the very people you're at war with, and then they'll let you go home. Now stop that. Stop acting like that, because we can do this to you anytime we want. So he prepared a great feast for them. When they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. And the marauding bands of the Arameans did not come again into the land of Israel. Well, I'll bet. Yeah, remember what happened last time? Let's just let that Elisha guy alone, because he'll confound us. He'll talk to his God, and his God will blind us. So again, this is God's miraculous provision. Not only did he protect Elisha with an army of angels in the mountains, had the Arameans attacked they would have been stopped by the armies of the angels. But at the same time, God could blind them, because God is in absolute sovereign control of everyone and everything. He could blind them, and then Elisha could walk out and speak to them and confuse them completely, and they would believe him when he said, no, you're at the wrong place, you're in the wrong city, follow me, I'll take you to the right place. Why would they believe him? They don't know him. They don't know his voice. Why would they believe him? I think that this is all just God giving them to Elisha, who then takes them into the middle of Samaria, opens their eyes. They, of course, would be terribly afraid. The king of Israel wants to kill them all. They figure they're going to be wiped out by their enemies, and instead they end up feasting and drinking wine and going home. Now, I think, from a tactical standpoint, had the king of Israel actually killed them all, what's going to be the natural response of the Arameans? The king of the Arameans is going to send in another army, and another, because you killed our first man that we sent in. This is a declaration of war. But we blinded you, confused you, led you, which, by the way, proves that Elisha can lead the armies of the Aramean king, which is really interesting, lead you into the middle of Israel, protect you from being killed, feed you, give you wine, send you home. Can you see why the king of the Arameans would go, well, I think that's enough. I think we're done here. He knows everything I'm going to do. He knows every move I'm going to make. God tells him what I think in my bedroom. And they were really good to us when they could have destroyed us. So, no more. Now, it came about after this, says verse 24. We don't know how much longer after this, but clearly a period of time has passed. In Samaria, in Israel, they had prepared a great feast. But the next thing we're going to read about is a great famine. So clearly, a lot of time has passed between what we call verse 23 and verse 24. Jeremiah, who is most likely the author of this book, is just reciting, listing, writing down moments in the history of Israel. If I was doing chapter divisions, that's where I would have stuck the chapter division. So it came about after this that Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, gathered all his army and went up and besieged Samaria. And we just got done reading that the marauding bands of Arameans did not come again into the land of Israel. So there was clearly a time of peace, but then time has gone by, and now there's a famine in the land. Verse 25, and there was a great famine in Samaria, and behold, they besieged it until a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver, and a fourth of a cob of dove's dung was sold for 5 shekels of silver. They were so hungry, there was so nothing to eat, that if there was a dead donkey head, you could sell that. If you could get bird dung, you could sell that, because they were just so hungry. Verse 26, and as the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him, saying, help, O Lord, O king. And he said, if the Lord, Yahweh, capital L-O-R-D, does not help you, from where shall I help you? From the threshing floor or from the wine press? In other words, he's saying there's nothing to eat, there's no grain, and there's no wine. I've got nothing to give you to eat, I've got nothing to give you to drink. The king said to her, what is the matter with you? And she answered, this woman said to me, give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat your son tomorrow. So we boiled my son and ate him. And I said to her on the next day, give your son that we may eat him, but she has hidden her son. She has gone to the king for justice. She's gone to the king and said, help me. He says, I can't help you. I have no food. That's not what she's upset about. She ate yesterday. But what she ate yesterday was her child. And she says, and the deal I made with this woman was that we would eat a child a day. Obviously, then we're talking about babies. We're talking about little to eat, if I can put it that way. And she's upset because the woman now has taken her child. and hidden him. She wants the king to execute justice to see that now they boil that woman's baby. So we boiled my son and we ate him. And I said to her on the next day, give your son that we may eat him, but she has hidden her son. And it came about that when the king heard the words of the woman, that he tore his clothes. He reacted the same way you all did. I saw your faces and your eyes. This is a harsh story. This is a difficult time in Israel's history. And, you know, for the king to show that kind of outward grieving, that kind of repentant grieving, was a very public thing because he's doing it on behalf of the nation. And so he tore his clothes. You might recall that earlier when he did this, that Elisha had heard that the king had torn his clothes and came right to the king, because this was a big deal for the king to tear his clothes. But when he heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes, and now he was passing by on the wall, and the people were looking at him, and behold, he had sackcloth beneath his body. When you wore sackcloth or ashes, you were repenting before God. It was a way of crying out to God. Typically, if you wore sackcloth and put ashes on your body, you would also bow down and put sand and dirt and rocks on your head. It was a way of getting as low as you could get. And the sackcloth itched and hurt. And so you were constantly reminded of your petitions before God, your prayers to God, the need for God. So it was a very physical way of showing your repentance before God. And so they noticed that when he tore his clothes, that he was wearing sackcloth. The king at this point had no answers for the people. The king at this point had no food. He had no way. He had nothing. And so he was doing the exact right thing. He was crying out to God. Then he said, may God do so to me and more also, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on him today. In other words, I got to do something. And there's a prophet in Israel, the only one that God speaks to, and this has befallen us. So what does he do? He blames him. Which, in some ways, if you think about the history of the prophets in Israel, kind of makes sense, because it was Elijah who prayed, and there was no rain for 3.5 years. And so the kings of Israel, remember, were not necessarily good kings. And so you could see where the king of Israel would say, well, then this is the prophet's fault. He's doing the same thing Elijah did when he brought about a famine. Clearly, Elisha has brought this famine about. So I'm going to cut his head off. And maybe, too, from a political standpoint, maybe he thought, well, as long as I do something, the people are looking at me. I got to do something. May God do so to me and more also, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on him today. Now Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him, and the king sent a man from his presence. But before the messenger came to him, he said to his elders, do you see how the son of a murderer, remember this is the son of Ahab, who's the king right now, do you see how the son of a murderer has sent to take away my head? He's sitting with his elders, and he's talking to them, and before the messenger even gets there, he tells the people in the room what's coming. He's aware that the king has sent for his head, because God has told him. God is still right there in their midst. God is still there talking to their prophet. God has not in any way changed. This terrible thing is going on in Israel. But God's still talking to his prophet. God hasn't changed. And by the way, no amount of human effort, like cutting off the head of a prophet, is going to fix it. The king sent a man from his presence, but before the messenger came to him, he said to the elders, do you see how this son of a murderer has sent to take away my head? Look, the messenger comes, shut the door, and hold the door shut against him. Is not the sound of his master's feet behind him? And while he was still talking to them, behold, the messenger came down to him, and he said, behold, this evil is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? Now, that is the way that we so commonly think. That's human thinking. This is clearly from the Lord, says the messenger of the king. This is the Lord's doing, and we're waiting on him. We're waiting, but there are women eating their own babies. Why should we wait any longer? Let's take action. Let's fix this ourselves. Let's kill the prophet. Let's do something. That's human thinking. But we even sing it. They that wait upon the Lord will renew their strength and will rise up with wings as eagles. Run and not be weary, walk and not faint. And then we add the phrase, teach me, Lord, to wait. Waiting on the Lord, trusting the Lord, even in the worst of your circumstances, is exactly what you're called to do. But human nature is to say, I'll fix this. This has gotten worse than my sensibilities can handle. And since my sensibilities can't handle it, I'm going to rise up and do what I want to do. Why should we wait on the Lord any longer? And then that's the end of chapter 6. And I could leave it there like a cliffhanger, but I'm not going to. We're going to read chapter 7 because the deliverance is astounding and it proves that God hadn't forgotten these people at all. Then Elisha said, listen to the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, tomorrow about this time, a measure of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel. That's like for a penny. And 2 measures of barley for a shekel will be sold right here in the gate of Samaria tomorrow. Within 24 hours, there's going to be so much food that you won't even be able to sell it for a good price. That's how much food you're going to have tomorrow. The royal officer, on whose hand the king was leaning, answered the man of God and said, behold, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, could this thing be? Then he said, behold, you shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it. Because you didn't believe it. You didn't believe me. You're going to see it, but you're not going to get to eat from it. Now, here's the story, starting in verse 3. Now there were 4 leprous men at the entrance of the gate. And they said to one another, why are we just sitting here until we die? If we say we will enter the city, then the famine is in the city and we'll die there. If we sit here, we also die. Now therefore come and let us go over to the camp of the Arameans. If they spare us, we'll live. If they kill us, we'll only die. We're dead anyway. So let's go to the camp of the Arameans. Maybe they'll take pity on us. 4 lepers are about to save all Israel. God uses the weak things. He doesn't use the king to do it. He uses 4 lepers whose attitude is, if we die, we die. They arose at twilight to go to the camp of the Arameans. And when they came to the outskirts of the camp of the Arameans, behold, there was no one there. For the Lord had caused the army of the Arameans to hear a sound of chariots and a sound of horses, even the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us. They made up their own rationale for why they were hearing what they were hearing. And they knew that it couldn't be the Israelites coming after them because they're hungry. So they figured, here's what he did. He made an allegiance with the Israelites, made an allegiance with the Egyptians and with the Hittites, and they know where we are, and they're coming to get us. God put a delusion on the army of the Arameans so that they heard chariots and horses coming, and they fled and left the camp sitting there. All their food, everything, just sitting there. Verse 7, therefore they arose and they fled in the twilight. They left their tents and their horses and their donkeys, and the camp was just like it was, and they fled for their life. Now when these lepers came to the outskirts of the camp, they entered one tent and they ate and drank. They had to have thought, this is like the best day ever. Look what we found. And they carried from there silver and gold and clothes and went and hid them. We are now rich lepers. 4 rich lepers, well fed, having a good day. And they returned and they entered another tent and carried from there also. And they went and hid that. Now they're just storing up treasure. And then they said to one another, we're not doing right. This day is a day of good news, and we're keeping silent. If we wait until morning light, punishment will overtake us. Now, therefore, come, let us go and tell the king's household. So they came, and they called to the gatekeepers of the city, and they told them, saying, we came to the camp of the Arameans, and behold, there was no one there, nor the voice of a man, only the horses tied and the donkeys tied and the tents just as they were. And the gatekeepers called and told it within to the king's household. And the king arose in the night and said to his servants, I will now tell you what the Arameans have done to us. They know that we are hungry. Therefore, they have gone from the camp and are hiding themselves in the field, saying, when they come out of the city, we shall capture them alive and go into the city. He's sure this is a plot. This is a plan. This can't be. This is too good. There's no way. There's just a camp full of horses and donkeys and food and clothes. And go. That can't be. This has to be a trick. One of his servants answered and said, please, let some men take 5 of the horses which remain, which are left in the city. In other words, well, behold, they will be in any case like all the multitude of Israel who are left in it. Behold, they will be in any case like all the multitude of Israel who have already perished. So let us send and see. In other words, rather than just say, this isn't going to work, at least send 5 men with 5 horses. Let's go find out. Isn't it worth the risk? So they took, therefore, 2 chariots with horses, and the king sent after the army of the Arameans, saying, go and see. And they went after them to the Jordan, and behold, all the way was full of clothes and equipment, which the Arameans had thrown away in their haste. Then the messengers returned and told the king. So the people went out, and they plundered the camp of the Arameans. And then a measure of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. Now the king appointed the royal officer, on whose hand he leaned, to have charge of the gate. But the people trampled him at the gate. Think about that. They're so hungry. They're so desperate for food that when they find out where the food is, they just trample right over this man who's standing in the gate as a representative of the king. At this point, they don't care king. They don't care leader. They just care food. Just go to where the food is. And they trampled him to death. The king appointed the royal officer on whose hand he leaned to have charge in the gate. But the people trampled on him at the gate. And he died just as the man of God had said, who spoke when the king came down to him. And it came about, just as the man of God had spoken to the king, saying, 2 measures of barley for a shekel and 1 measure of fine flour for a shekel shall be sold tomorrow about this time in the gate of Samaria. And then the royal officer answered the man of God and said, now behold, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, how could such a thing be? And he had said, behold, you shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it. And so it happened to him. For the people trampled on him at the gate, and he died. So, blessing abundant, God taking care of his people, and in the exact same action, at the exact same time, a curse on a man who didn't believe God. Now, think about that for a moment, because if there's ever a time when we're going to question God, if there's ever a time where we're going to question God's veracity, we're going to question his word, we're going to question whether or not he cares, it's going to be when things are bad. And really put flesh and blood on this for a moment, because if you're that guy, if you're that attendant to the king, and people are starving, people are eating their children, it's desperate, it's terrible. They're willing to pay a big price for bird dung. They're that hungry. And the man of God says, tomorrow, abundance. Can you see why, after the flesh, after human rationality, he would say, how can that be? If God were to open the windows of heaven, how is he going to make up for all this? That's a very human, rational question. It also got him cursed, because If there's ever a time we're going to not believe God, it's when things are bad. Bad, bad, bad. That's when you're not going to believe God. It's so easy to believe God when it's all good. It's so easy to follow God, believe His word, do the right things, do some giving, go to church, take care of people, everything. It's good. It's good. But when it goes bad, when it all goes south, that's when we're going to say, where is God in this? Just remember, this guy was cursed for that question. That's an important lesson, and it tells you something very important about the nature and the character of God, which is, I'm God in the good times, I'm God in the bad times, and you don't question me either way, because I can keep this famine on you forever if I want. But in 24 hours, I can give you abundance if I want. Because I'm still God, and I'm still sovereign, and I'm still in charge, and I still do whatever I want to do, and I won't be questioned. And yet we're so quick to question Him, aren't we? We're so quick to go, where are you? Why would you do this to me? Why me? And we do it under much better circumstances than Israel was in when this man did it. So I hope you've learned an important lesson about God, the character and the nature of God. And remember, if you take nothing else away from tonight, remember, number one, yes, He's there. Yes, He cares. Yes, He's aware. Yes, He's involved. He's omnipresent. He's there. He's omniscient. He knows what's going on. But He's also omnipotent. He empowers everything. He's the one that's making this happen. He has given Himself the proper name, El Shaddai, God Almighty. He has all the power, which means He has the power at any moment. By the way, notice again, He could have taken all that food and substance and everything from the Arameans before the famine. He could have brought rain and avoided the famine. He could have, by His power, His might, His determination, He could have kept Israel out of all of that. But Israel has had a succession of evil kings. And they've been worshiping foreign gods. And God told them right at the beginning, if you chase after other gods, I'll bring famine on you. And they chase after foreign gods, and God brings famine on them. Because He's consistent to His own word. He already told them He was going to do it, and now He did it. But He's also a merciful and a gracious God. And right when everything is at the break point, He delivers them. Not for them, not for their sake, but because He is a God who keeps His word. He has chosen these people. He is going to deliver these people. So, it went bad for them. Whose fault is that? Well, ultimately theirs, because they chased after their other gods. But who brought about the punishment on them? Well, God did, because God said that He was going to. But then they were delivered from the punishment, delivered from the famine, and had an abundance not only of food, but of stuff and clothes and horses and donkeys and gold and all the stuff. They had all that. God gave them all that. Why? Because of them? No. They wanted to kill His prophet over it. Why did He do it? Because He's still a gracious God, and He's still a promise-keeping God, and He still delivers His people. So when it goes bad for you, don't start shaking your fist and questioning Him, saying, where are you and why are you doing this? We have ample evidence that He doesn't take well to those kind of questions. And remember, He's here, and He cares, and He's involved, and He'll get you through this. And they that are with us are more than they that are with them. He's got His angelic army watching over us, taking care of us, protecting us. How do I know that? Because we're not just wayfaring Israel. We're not just stiff-necked, hard-headed Israel, we're the body of Christ. We are the betrothed and promised bride of Christ. I mean, He has already chosen us to give as a gift to His Son. You think He'll send angels to take care of us? I think He will. You got it?
Yes, sir.
That's a good place for an amen.
Amen.
All right.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. We welcome your feedback and encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.